Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey everybody, we got a great one today because my guest is MSNBC analyst Peter Beinart. And I know some of you may love him and some of you may not, because we're going to be talking about Israel and Peter's new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. Now, if you think Netanyahu has done a fabulous job in responding to Hamas's monstrous October 7th attack, you may find this one a bit challenging, but I hope you stay with us and hear what Peter has to say. I read this book and I learned a lot, and I think no matter what your views are, you'll walk away with a deeper understanding of the history of the region and of Peter's views. But before we go to my discussion with Peter, I want to talk a little about the devastating plane crash in D.C., which occurred on Wednesday night. My heart goes out to the families of the victims. It disgusts me that Trump is using this to push his anti-DEI agenda by blaming the crash on alleged DEI hires at the FAA. On Thursday afternoon, Trump signed a presidential action for the Secretary of Transportation and the administrator of the FAA, criticizing the Obama and Biden administrations, their use of DEI, and claiming that these hiring practices had rendered the FAA unsafe. In this memorandum, Trump claims that the FAA was, and I quote, specifically recruiting individuals with severe intellectual disabilities. In a press conference, he then implied these individuals became air traffic controllers. No, that is not true. This is disgraceful, which is entirely predictable behavior from him. So we need to ask ourselves, why is Trump spreading this nonsense? So I have a thought, though it may not have stopped the crash. Trump is distracting us from the fact that he did not appoint a new FAA administrator until Thursday, the day after the crash. The former FAA administrator was pressured to step down when Trump took office because Elon Musk didn't want him to keep going after SpaceX. Now, we don't know what caused the crash. There will be an investigation by the NTSB, and we will find out what caused this horrible tragedy. But I'm willing to predict that it wasn't the FAA's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion program. Anyway, we got a great one today, you know, for a change. Peter Beinart on his new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Being Jewish after the destruction of Gaza, a reckoning by Peter Beinart. And this is an important book. It's an eye-opening book, includes a lot of history that I did not know from the perspective of someone who's obviously a very devout Jew, whose identity as a Jew is very central to his life. So welcome, Peter.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
In the book, you write, "We are not history's permanent virtuous victims." What do you mean by that?
What I meant is that Jews have suffered a huge amount throughout our history, but we're human beings, which means that we can have the whole same range of human experiences as any other group of people. And so if you kind of try to imagine that Israel and Palestine in 2024 is like the situation of Jews in the Russian Empire in 1903, mm-hmm. or in Germany, God forbid, in 1942, you're really blinding yourself to some really fundamental differences, that the position of Jews vis-a-vis Palestinians is very different than the position of Jews vis-a-vis Germans or Russians a century ago.
What should Israel have done? I mean, the book is Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. What should Israel have done after the monstrous attack on October 7th?
I think Israel should have recognized that its problem with the Palestinians is not a military problem. It's a political problem. At its heart, the problem is that Israelis and Palestinians are living next to each other, but most of those Palestinians don't have basic human rights. In the West Bank, they live as permanent non-citizens under military law. They can't vote for the government that has life and death power over them. In Gaza, they're also under Israeli control in a different way. It's like what Human Rights Watch has called an open-air prison.
Where are Israeli Palestinian citizens?
Great question. So about 30% or so of the Palestinians who live under Israeli control are Palestinian citizens. We sometimes call them Arab Israelis. They do have citizenship and the right to vote. So their status is a lot better than Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem. They don't have equal citizenship. For instance, Israel has like a legally segregated school system. There's actually no legal marriage in Israel, but across religious lines. And there are other examples that I could give. Most of the land in Israel is controlled by an institution that gives almost half its seats to the Jewish National Fund, which develops land only for Jewish use. But there is an important distinction. One like really crude way of thinking about it might be to think about like, what was it like for Black Americans in the early 20th century in the North versus the South, right? There was an important difference because in the North you could vote, but you still weren't really equal, even, in New York or Chicago in 1940 or 1930. If Israel doesn't face this fundamental problem, which is that you're denying people basic freedom, and that when you deny people freedom, you inflict a lot of violence on them, even if you don't always think about it, that you're actually creating a more dangerous situation.
Let me go back to the question of what should Israel have done after October 7th, because I think that everybody felt that there had to be some military action. I think everybody thought that. Now, it sounds like you're saying, no, that's only...
Well, it's a little bit like the question is, I have a toothache. It's a really, really bad toothache, right? And I have to do something. And so what I do is I hit myself in the head with a brick. I've done something, right? But the toothache is still there. And I've also caused myself a lot of other problems. Hamas, Israel has destroyed most of the universities, schools, buildings, agriculture in Gaza. And Hamas is still there.
It took me a while to say, oh, this is too much, you know? And I was like, but that wasn't until like early January or something.
Right.
And it felt like some military response was, you know, needed, but you're saying no.
Well, if you had a military response that targeted the leaders of Hamas and the mastermind of these organizations, right? You know, some of whom were in Gaza, but many of whom were also in other parts of the world, right? I wasn't going to shed any tears for Yahya Sinwar and other people who were the leadership of Hamas. But the problem is that the military response was a response of collective punishment, right? Where Israel basically says, right at the beginning, you have Golan, you know, that we're going to turn off the water, the food, and the fuel. So you're punishing everybody, right? Which, first of all, just isn't fair. But secondly, what do you think is going to happen from a security point of view when you start starving people and killing tens of thousands of people, right? You know what's going to happen? Hamas, and we know this.
You're going to create more Hamas.
You're going to create more Hamas. That's the way Hamas recruits. So this is why, even though Israel has killed so many Hamas fighters, they're now all these new Hamas fighters, because when you kill people's families, they're going to want to fight you.
There's a story in your book about two leaders, of one of the Islamic Jihad and the other of Hamas.
Right.
A 9-year-old boy seeing his uncle shot and a 3-year-old.
Yes.
Seeing his father shot.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes. So in 1956, the Gaza Strip was under Egyptian control between 1948 and 1967. But Israel used to go in there sometimes because there were Palestinian fighters. This is long before Hamas existed, by the way. But there were Palestinian fighters who were basically coming out of Gaza Strip to attack Israel. Sometimes they were just people trying to go back to their land from which they were expelled. And so Israel, in one particularly big raid in 1956, goes in and it kills like 275 Palestinians in the town of Khan Yunis in Gaza. And the current leader of Islamic Jihad, which is like Hamas's smaller but equally militant rival, which was also involved in October 7th, he was a 3-year-old, Ziad al-Nakhli. He saw his father killed. One of the main leaders of Hamas, Abdelaziz Rantisi, was 9 and saw his uncle killed. And the point that I'm trying to make is, these are the long-term effects of what happens when you kill a lot of people, right? Is that you are breeding and creating the conditions for the next group of people. And it really, as someone who cares a lot, as I know you do, a lot about Israeli Jews, I have a lot of people who are I'm very close to in that place. They're very important to me. October 7th was one of the most traumatic and horrifying days of my life. And I think about how many 3-year-olds and 9-year-olds and what they may want to do 10 or 20 or 70 years from now to take revenge because of what's happened. It makes me scared for Israelis.
There's a story also you have about this great guy who hates Hamas, lives in Gaza, and it's kind of a long story, but at the end, he gets killed. But while he's dying, he said, now was favored Hamas, right?
Yes, this was I never had the honor of meeting this guy, but a friend of mine.
Sounded like a wonderful man.
Yes, and he was very close friends with my friend Mohammed Shahada, who I would really recommend his work to people. Mohammed is an extraordinary journalist and thinker, grew up in Gaza with his friend Ali. And he talks about how Ali had a principled opposition to the use of violence against civilians. And he also didn't like Islamism, as a lot of people in Gaza don't. But the trauma that was inflicted upon him and his family after October 7th was so harrowing that at the end of the day, he basically said something along the lines of, you know, these Israelis don't understand anything except for force. We have to fight them militarily. And one of the things that Mohammed has told me about his conversations with folks in Hamas, because he grew up with folks in Hamas around Gaza, is that they would say things to him like, Mohammed, I know you believe in nonviolence. I know you believe in international law, but your way has not worked. What has it gotten us? So why not try it our way? And that's one of the points I really want to emphasize, which is if we believe that October 7th was profoundly wrong and that Palestinians should never target Israeli civilians, we have to support nonviolent, ethical Palestinian struggles for freedom. But the U.S. and Israel have done exactly the opposite.
Jimmy Carter wrote Peace, Not Apartheid. Can you just describe the way the Palestinians in Israel are second-class citizens, except that they're not citizens?
Well, the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and most of the Palestinians in East Jerusalem are not citizens. So that means that they live under the control of a state, but they can't become its citizens. They can't vote for its government. In the West Bank, Jews and Palestinians live under a different legal system. So if a Jew and a Palestinian get into a fight, The Jewish settler is going to go to a civil court where they have due process. The Palestinian is going to go to a military court with a 99% prosecution rate where you can be held virtually in indefinite detention. B'Tselem, Israel's own leading human rights organization, has classified this as apartheid. The Palestinian citizens are a minority of Palestinians under Israeli control. They do have citizenship. It's a kind of second-class citizenship. So again, I mean, the point of my book is one of the things American Jews should think about is if we believe so strongly in equality and law here, that government shouldn't treat people equally based on race, religion, and sex, and we're fighting with everything we have against Trump and these lunatics on the Christian white nationalist right who want to change that, why don't we support that principle there too?
What do you favor in terms of Israel and what should be done as a solution? A two-state solution? I sense that you're not for that.
I don't think a two-state solution is possible anymore. I think that Israel's control of the West Bank is just way too deep and way too entrenched. I also think that a two-state solution doesn't get at some of the fundamental underlying issues, which is to say, if the idea is you can have a two-state solution so you can have a Jewish state, right, which means that the state has to be run by Jews, right?
Right.
When people talk in those terms in America, like we have to have an 80% white Christian, yeah, that's Tucker Carlson language, right?
Well, but the history of Israel is quite different.
Yes.
The Holocaust is sort of the justification. And the thinking behind that is after all this persecution over all these centuries, it looks like Jews need their own homeland, of course, in Israel, where they originally were.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's the thinking there. And you say a two-state solution is not possible now. When did that become impossible?
I went back looking in something I wrote earlier for the first time that I saw someone saying that a two-state solution was almost dead because the Israeli settler population in the West Bank, you know, the West Bank would be the heartland of where this Palestinian state would be.
Yeah, well, I remember when Kerry was Secretary of State.
Right.
We talked and he said that where the settlements are going is deliberately making a two-state solution impossible.
Right. I think he said, you know, maybe there were a couple more years. That was almost a decade ago. There's a column I found in the New York Times by Anthony Lewis in 1982 called 5 Minutes to Midnight. They thought that there might be 100,000 settlers in the West Bank. They're now West Bank and East Jerusalem, maybe more 700,000 settlers. And yeah, this is eventually like saying you're going to have a pizza, but we've now eaten 5/8 of the pizza.
It's more like we've eaten several slices.
Several slices, yes.
Which constitute 5/8 of the pizza. Yes. We've eaten 5 pieces.
Yes, yes.
If you don't do a two-state solution, you have a one-state solution, right?
Right.
And would the right of return be available
yes.
too?
Yes, I think so. I don't see how it's fair for someone like you or me, Al, to be able to go to Israel on day one and become a citizen, even though our families have not lived there for a very, very long time. Whereas a Palestinian who literally was born there, or their children, who was expelled in 1948, doesn't have the right to return. I mean, do we think that they don't love this place as much as we do? A lot of Palestinians may choose they may not want to, but I think Palestinians should have that right to live there if they want to. Yes. And that's part of the reason a two-state solution can't accommodate that, because the idea of a two-state solution is we got to keep the Jewish majority up at 80% or at least 70%. And so if some Palestinians come, it could go down to 60%. And what are we going to do?
No, I disagree. Because a two-state solution says a two-state solution. It means that if Palestinians have the right of return and the population of the Palestinian state is larger than Israel, Israel still has its Jewish state and still has elections and determine their own destiny. I don't think that contradicts.
Well, but like, most Palestinians are not necessarily from the West Bank or Gaza. Let's say you live in Minneapolis and you were born in Haifa or Jaffa or Lod or Sfat. These are all places inside Israel proper, right? And you were expelled or your parents were expelled and you want to go and live and return to the town where your family is from. I think people should have that right. And I think the fact that it would undermine the Jewish percentage shouldn't stop us, because I think that this way of thinking about percentages as the route to safety, I just think is fundamentally wrong.
I think if you have a democracy, and you need over 50% for it to be a Jewish state. So if it's a two-state solution and there's a Palestinian state, where would that be? Would it be Gaza, the West Bank?
And East Jerusalem, presumably.
And East Jerusalem. Okay. Then there's Israel, which is not those places. Where it's Israel minus those places, right?
Right, right.
It seems to me that identifying as a Jewish state, you would want ideally to have a majority Jews deciding their destiny.
Right. But the consequences of that are, first of all, then you need essentially like kind of an Ann Coulter style like immigration policy, which basically says Jews can come and other people can't come, even if those people were from here and were expelled. And secondly, it means that the Palestinian citizens, the ones who, even those who have citizenship, the ones who live in, you know, in these places I mentioned, like Haifa or Jaffa, they can never be equal citizens in a Jewish state, a state that basically has decided that Jews are the folks who are going to rule. To me, the irony about this is that Jews are 2% of the population in the United States, right? We're less than 2% of the population in Britain and in Australia and Canada and France. And you know what? Jews are safer in all of those places than they are in Israel. And I think Israel is just about the most dangerous large community for a Jew to live in the world, even though we have a Jewish state dedicated to Jewish self-protection. And I think it's because when you deny people basic rights, you inflict violence on them, and that violence endangers you.
Well, we have the Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, to keep the population up. So,
yes, they're doing a good job of that.
Yeah, is there any chance that this cycle can be broken?
I don't know.
And who would do that? Who would do that? We know Netanyahu has been there. Is Netanyahu there because of October 7th, and has continued to be there because of October 7th?
I think he is exploited, and he's kind of used the fact that this war has gone on and on to kind of keep himself in power. But, you know, he's basically been prime minister with a 1-year gap since 2009 now. And I think if you want to understand why Benjamin Netanyahu has been so politically successful over now the last, 15 years or so, I think a big part of the reason is the United States. America has helped him enormously politically, because Netanyahu's claim has always been inside Israel that we can really do whatever we want to the Palestinians, and we're going to be fine. It's not going to imperil our relationship with the United States or Europe. And his centrist opponents like Ehud Barak and Tzipi Livni were saying, we can't get away with this. We're going to be a pariah. And Netanyahu said, just watch us. And the fact that America has basically given Israel total impunity, that we protect Israel, has actually strengthened Netanyahu politically.
I think Biden made a mistake. I think when he stopped the 2,000-pound bombs at one point, right? Then continued them.
Yeah. I mean, you would know this much better than me, Al, because you're closer to these folks. But to me, I just don't understand how a presidential administration, you know, that speaks about democracy and human rights as central to their mission in the world and condemns Russia, as they should, for what Russia did in Ukraine and condemns China, can basically send all these weapons to a place where the number of children who've been killed dwarfs the number of children who've been killed in Ukraine, even though Gaza is 1/20th the size.
And he could have used those as leverage.
Yes, America has a huge amount of leverage. I mean, Israel's a strong country, but they can't fight this war without American weapons, and they can't fight it without American protection. If it wasn't for the United States, Benjamin Netanyahu would have a lot of trouble traveling around the world, because he'd be worried that he'd be arrested and brought to trial in the International Criminal Court. And the U.S. basically gives him the impunity to continue doing what he's doing.
You write, Israel can't destroy Hamas for the same reason the United States couldn't destroy the Viet Cong or the Taliban. The British couldn't defeat the Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland. You talk about Northern Ireland. You talk about South Africa. Did you grow up in South Africa? Or?
Yeah, my parents emigrated just before I was born, but we used to go there a lot when I was a kid. So I spent a lot of time in apartheid South Africa in my childhood.
So do the Palestinians have a Mandela?
Well, the first thing it's important to remember is that Mandela didn't believe in nonviolence, right? Mandela and the ANC believed in armed resistance. So, Mandela was a great man. I don't deny that. But I think it's sometimes we sanitize these things in retrospect. Mandela, the ANC was considered a terrorist organization by the United States government. If there is a Nelson Mandela, Palestinian Mandela, the person who's mentioned most frequently is this guy Marwan Barghouti, who has been in jail in Israel for more than 20 years now. He's not an Islamist like Hamas. He is more popular than Hamas. He was involved in armed attacks during the Second Intifada. There's no question about that. But he's also talked about the legacy of Mandela and about reconciliation and about justice. And so it seems to me, you know, if you want to make sure that Hamas doesn't rule the Palestinians, because, you know, we don't believe in Islamism as an ideology. We hate what they did on October 7th.
What they did was just barbaric.
Yes, they did. What they did was barbaric. And I'm happy using the term barbaric, but I also want to make it clear that to destroy most of the hospitals and universities and schools and buildings, that's also barbaric.
And Israelis would say they deliberately do that. Hamas deliberately embeds in hospitals.
Yes,
and that's true.
They would say that Hamas is fighting in amongst the civilian population, and therefore we have the right to kill the civilians who live near the Hamas people. That's the logic, right?
Right. You know what? Right. That's the logic.
The Israeli Defense Ministry, the Kiryat, Israel's military headquarters, is not located in some remote part of Israel. It's in downtown Tel Aviv. There are 24, we did a count for the book, schools within a kilometer and a half. So if Hamas or some other Palestinian group decides they're going to blow up some of those schools because they want to destroy Israel's military headquarters, or they destroy an apartment building because there's some high-ranking Israeli military generals there, do they get to say, oh, that's justified because they were used as human shields?
Well, when Iran sent their missiles, they weren't not aiming for that. They got shot down, most of them, almost all of them.
Right, which is a good thing. But the point I make in the book is that this human shields argument is used by every government army that kills civilians. The Russians, immediately when they went into Ukraine, they accused the Ukrainian military, which was fighting from Kiev in all mm-hmm. around civilian areas trying to defend the city. They said, you're using human shields. The U.S. said it in Vietnam. They said, the Viet Cong have built these tunnels underneath the population, and they sent leaflets saying that the Viet Cong were using the Vietnamese people as human shields. This is always the argument that people make when they kill huge numbers of civilians. And on international law, even if fighters are in close proximity to civilians, you are still governed by the law, the rules of proportionality. You can't destroy a hospital because you think that there's some Hamas fighters there.
I know. I agree. But I'm trying to channel Netanyahu. What would he say?
You need to do the accent a little better, but you got the lines down.
His mom was from Minneapolis, you know.
Really? I didn't know that. I didn't know.
Yeah.
So you're to blame.
Yes. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Peter Beinart.
Moro Casino. America's Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
And we are back with Peter Beinart. Where is Israel now politically? It seems to me that, and maybe this is because of the ultra-Orthodox, but it seems to have moved very much to the right.
It has moved to the right. It's partly because of the demographic shift, not just ultra-Orthodox, but what we might call in America modern Orthodox, or in Israel they call national religious. So those are people like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich. They're not exactly ultra-Orthodox, but they are highly, highly nationalistic in a very, very extreme way, and basically want to expel the Palestinians. So yes, those forces are growing partly because of demographic shifts. But I also think it's because, in a way that, as I said before, because of the impunity that Israel has had, that other Israelis have not had to face the costs and the consequences of what Israel's doing. And that has empowered people who say, well, we can keep on doing it.
And what does that mean? What does it mean, keep on doing it? Just keep on subjugating Palestinians? And
I think it's, my fear is that it will be worse than that. My fear is that if nothing changes, that what we will be heading over the coming decades and generations will be what you might call the American solution to the Palestinian question, by which I mean the American solution in the 19th century to the Native American population, which is, we didn't set up a two-state solution along the Mississippi River and say, okay, we've gone this far, you can have the rest, right? We continued, and basically the Native American population was so destroyed, we didn't kill every last person, but they couldn't be a political force anymore. They couldn't threaten us anymore. They couldn't do anything.
There'll be a long march?
Look at what Trump just said. Trump just said, we should clear out the Gaza Strip, and they should go to Egypt or Jordan.
Now, does that mean permanently or?
Well, I mean, Israel has never let any of the refugees that it expelled in 1948 back. It also expelled a whole bunch in 1967. It's never let any of those people back.
But our solution has the right of return. Your solution.
Yes.
Which is now our solution.
Right. I appreciate that. No, yes. I think my fear is that where we may be heading is towards simply the destruction of the Palestinian population, in which through a process of expulsion and death and pushing people into smaller and smaller kind of ghettos, again, like what happened to Native Americans, they were forced into smaller and smaller areas. Palestinians are now not even going to be, even if they can stay in Gaza, Israel has made it clear that they won't be able to be in even all of Gaza. And Gaza is half the size of New York City. It was already one of the most overcrowded places on earth. The UN said that to rebuild Gaza and even get it to the place that it was on October 7th, and it was considered unlivable by the UN then, that even to get it back to that GDP would take 80 years under the current growth rate. And in the West Bank, Palestinians are being cleared out of entire villages, again, forced to leave or forced into more and more crowded areas with settlers controlling more and more of the land. So this is where I fear we're headed unless good people in America and the rest of the world change our policy.
Well, Trump is not going to do that, right?
No, I don't think Trump's going to do it. The question, you know, you would know this much better than me. I think the question is the Democratic Party going to change so the next Democratic president acts differently than Joe Biden did?
Well, I have no way of knowing that. I don't know it better than you, but I hope that's the case.
Yeah, I hope it's the case too. You know, I just think that, look, there, you can criticize the Palestinian Solidarity Movement. There have been some slogans that I don't like. There have been individual things that have been harassment of Jewish students. That's all true.
You do a few paragraphs about From the River to the Sea.
Yes.
And it can mean different things, right?
It can mean different things, right. So the first point that I'd make about River to the Sea is that there already is a country from the river to the sea. The Israeli government actually uses that phrase a lot to describe the territory. And we know what it means. It means a state that Israel's own human rights organizations call apartheid because most of the Palestinians don't have basic rights. So people don't seem to be so upset about that river, the sea, which actually exists. What they're upset about is a theoretical river to the sea, Palestine from the river to the sea, which doesn't exist, which when Rashida Tlaib says it, they say, ah, what you mean is that in this future hypothetical Palestine from the river to the sea, you want to expel all the Jews or kill them all, right? And then Rashida Tlaib says, no, actually, I want them to live together equally. And then people say, no, we don't believe you.
So she was censured for that?
She was censured, right.
And she really meant, I mean, you're talking about not a two-state solution,
right.
A one-state solution.
Yes.
Therefore, both the Palestinians and the Israelis would be from the river to the sea.
Exactly. They could live anywhere they wanted. The settlers could stay where they live now in the West Bank. They just have to live equally alongside people who have the same rights as them. Now, I don't doubt that there are some other people, like in Hamas, when they say river to the sea, Palestine, they mean an Islamic state, right? So that's not a state in which Jews are treated equally, or for that matter, Christians would be treated equally either. So I think we should ask people what they mean by this. But the problem is that people just assume that what you mean is that you want the Jews dead. And there was a super interesting poll that was actually done by the University of Chicago. So they asked Jewish students on college campuses, does Palestine from the river to the sea mean that the Jews will be expelled or killed? I can't remember how they phrased it. And 2/3 of the Jewish students said yes. But when they asked the Muslim students, only 14% said yes. The Muslim students didn't think it meant that the Jews in Israel would be expelled.
I see.
They had a very different interpretation of it. And I think that's what's lost in this conversation.
That gives Tlaib a lot of bona fides there, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think there's a very often dehumanizing way that people talk about Palestinians in America, that Palestinians just wake up in the morning basically like hankering for Jewish blood, right? And so we think, oh my gosh, if they ever got their druthers, you know, there'd be concentration camps set up, or the Jews would be forced out on boats in the Mediterranean Sea. But when you actually listen to Palestinians, you know, again, and they're not, Palestinians disagree. There are Palestinian Islamists who have a vision that is different, that I oppose completely. But most Palestinians who I know and who I listen to and I talk to are talking about a vision of equality and historical justice. They're not saying Israeli Jews shouldn't be there. They're just saying Israeli Jews shouldn't have rights that they don't have.
Right. So the vision is of a one state. This is as opposed to a two-state solution. One state where Palestinians and Jews live side by side. And peace.
Yes, and inequality.
And equality.
Yeah, and I think it would be safer for Israeli Jews, because I think you're safer when your neighbors have rights. You know, think about how much more dangerous life would be for white Southerners if Black people hadn't gotten the vote in 1965. Because then Black people wouldn't have had any way of expressing their discontent and trying to get the government to listen to them, except by fighting. You know, and one of the points I make in the book is that the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, the Arab Israelis, they're a lot less frightening to Israeli Jews than the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, even though they're all Palestinians. In fact, a lot of Israel's doctors and nurses and pharmacists are Palestinian citizens.
Yeah, you said something like 60% of the pharmacists.
60% of the pharmacists. So Israeli Jews are getting pills all the time. They don't seem terribly concerned that those pills are going to include, you know, lethal materials that are going to kill them. And I think a big part of the reason is that those Palestinians have citizenship. So they have some way of getting the government to listen to them. And when people have some representation, even if it's not full equality, then there tends to be less violence. I think that's the lesson of Northern Ireland. It's a lesson of post-apartheid South Africa. And it's a lesson of the post-civil rights United States.
As I said, you spent some time in South Africa, so you're familiar with their peace process, how Mandela left prison. How long did that take from the time he left prison till it became a democracy?
He was released in 1990, and then they had the free election in 1994.
That's amazing.
Yes. Now, a lot had happened before that to get to that place, but the thing that I think people might not realize about South Africa and white South Africans is that almost all white South Africans in the 1980s believed that if there was a Black government, if Black people got the vote and they formed a government, that white people would be like in mortal danger. Remember, white South Africans are only 10% of the population, as opposed to Israeli Jews who are 50% of the population. And they were also much more isolated around the world than Israeli Jews are. So they were completely terrified. They were like, listen, the ANC is considered a terrorist organization. It's getting its arms from the Soviet Union. The PAC, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the other Black anti-apartheid group, its unofficial motto was one settler, one bullet. These people were terrified. They were like, apartheid is what keeps us safe. If white people aren't in charge, we're going to be in danger. But actually, what happened was very different, because once Black people got the vote, the military wing of the ANC disbanded. Just like once the Catholics in Northern Ireland got equality, the IRA stopped blowing up things in London because they had a voice in government now.
Well, those two models maybe augur some better future, but we got Jews involved. So.
Well, we're a complicated group of people, but I fundamentally believe that we're really not that different than everybody else. We have this, and even though our history is particularly torturous, and I think we can learn something from those other societies that a lot of white people ended up feeling after civil rights, even if their family's been against it, that it was like liberation from them, that they felt a lifting of the burden once they didn't have this supremacy anymore. And you hear that from white South Africans, you hear it from Protestants in Northern Ireland. I think a lot of Jews might actually feel like a burden was being lifted from us too.
What reaction are you getting to the book?
You know, I know that there are a lot of people, including people who I know and in my community, who really, really won't like it. They don't like to see me parading around out there saying all these mean things about Israel and, you know, supposedly getting some credit for it because I'm Jewish. And, you know, nobody likes that. A lot of people don't like the idea of a turncoat, you know, someone like a traitor, you know.
I mean, you changed your views, right? You changed your views after you started meeting Palestinians.
I did. My views were completely different, you know, up before I started spending time with Palestinians in the West Bank, you know. And I often find that, you know, a lot of people in the Jewish community, including people I know, they're like, Peter, you're so naive about Palestinians. You're this liberal, you eat at Zabar's. You're so, you know, you have these utopian notions. You're so naive. And I'm like, how many Palestinians do you know well? Because I'm talking to Palestinians all the time. And so what made you the expert on Palestinians? Have you read any books by Palestinians? You have many deep political conversations. I find in general that the Jews who know Palestinians the best are actually the ones who are least afraid of Palestinians and most optimistic about the idea that Jews and Palestinians could live together equally.
That must stop them a little bit.
Well, I mean,
not really.
You know,
huh?
Sometimes to be,
do you have this conversation with them at Zabar's?
Not usually. Zabar's a little pricey, but you know, at some other places, I have these conversations, and people will sometimes say, "Well, okay, maybe there's some good Palestinians." But I really do believe that if it became more normal just for us to listen to Palestinians, if your average American synagogue invited a Palestinian in to come and talk about their life experience or what happened to their family in 1948, I think it would touch people. I really do. And because I've just seen it happen so often. And I think one of the things that happens on college campuses that they only talk about how the Jewish kids are being threatened and menaced and all this stuff. But a lot of times what happens is the Jewish kids get to know Palestinian kids and they come to a different understanding because of human contact that their parents and grandparents haven't had.
Well, that makes sense. Well, that bodes well, I suppose. Thank you. And good luck with this, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. Peter Beinart, thank you for gracing our podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Moro Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.